Hey, John.
Hey, Drew.
You want to listen to this new album I got?
Oh, what is it?
Here, I'll put it on.
Okay.
All right. I'm going to hit play. What do you think?
Well, it sounds kind of, I don't know. It's very quiet.
Yeah, man. That's the idea. There's nothing on here. It's 12 tracks of silence.
Oh.
Oh, wait. This is my favorite part. Oh. I'm Drew.
And I'm John.
And you're listening to The Hourchive,
our ever-growing library of everything, 1 hour at a time.
We're talking about concept albums, and for the purposes of this show,
conceptually speaking, this episode,
we are including under that category, under that umbrella, double albums.
Yeah.
Though they may not necessarily be a concept album.
It's an event album is really what we're talking about.
A large format album.
Something that is more than just a collection of songs.
It's a big idea. Yeah.
It's a big idea.
Taken as a whole.
Idea albums.
And I was trying to think about this, like a definition, my own personal definition for a concept album or a double album. And I think what I landed on was that the album taken as a whole is better than any individual track on it.
That's a good definition. I think that's a great definition.
That's not a literal definition.
No, it doesn't have to be.
But I think that's how I'll define it.
Okay.
And I will maybe I will apply that. Well, I won't apply that to a double album. Double albums are just two albums sold as one.
Right. Well, not necessarily. No. Not necessarily.
All right. Then
some of them could be sold individually.
What?
Yeah.
How?
But released at the same time.
Oh, okay.
You know what I'm saying? Like,
I could see what you mean. So a multiple release.
That's not exactly a double album necessarily. But it's,
concept albums, double albums, multi-release albums.
Yeah.
I like it.
Okay.
I like it.
What do you like about it?
About concept albums?
Yeah.
I think it's a really, when done well, is a really thought-provoking medium.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I think you highlighted it in your definition. I think the fact that you can have something that is, as a whole, greater than the sum of its parts.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, something that only really achieves what it's achieving through hearing it in the right sequence all at once, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's impressive not only in that it can evoke, you know, certain feelings or emotions or thoughts, whatever, right, as you're listening, but that it's an impressive feat to do it, you know?
Yeah, to actually accomplish that.
To accomplish that. Even if, I would go so far as to say is, even if the end product is not necessarily great or even good, I think there's something impressive just
the attempt.
In the attempt. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you have to have a goal in mind, right?
Yeah.
You have to have a message or a story or something that you feel one song can't accomplish,
right?
Or that one experience can't accomplish, that it requires an investment on both the artist's part and the listener or viewer, whatever, right, their part, an investment of time and attention that perhaps isn't required in a single song.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Cause you're basically, you're saying from the get go, like, you know, what you're used to doing is flipping through these songs mm-hmm. and occasionally you like them, occasionally yeah. you don't, but you know, as long as you enjoy some of them, you're good. But what we're going to ask you to do now is to listen to this whole thing.
Yeah.
You know,
and there may be parts that you don't particularly enjoy,
right.
or that you understand on this first listening, the right. first time through, or that may not seem to make sense until you get to the end. Mm-hmm. We're asking you to make this leap of faith that once you've heard all of it, that it will become clear.
That it will work for you.
Right.
Yeah, overall.
Right.
Do you remember the first time you...
heard one?
Yeah. Or were you... Okay, let me backtrack from
back
that.
Back it up.
Backing it up, because I want to go back to this idea that you... That agreement is implicit when mm-hmm. you buy a concept album.
Yeah.
Or are listening to a concept album. How does that get conveyed?
Yeah.
You know, how do you know? I mean, short of... Like, I guess... Now, most of the time, if I pick up an album mm-hmm. and it is a concept album, I know ahead
yeah.
that it's that there is a concept behind it because
yeah.
the press has reported it,
right.
or you know, or there'll be some sticker on it, or
yeah.
you know, something will tell me that you know this is a
yeah.
an event album. You know, this is it's there's a theme here you're supposed to follow.
Yeah,
but I don't think that was always the case.
Right. Well, I think, you know, before the idea of a concept album was really prevalent, then it would have required the artists themselves in some way getting that message out, right?
Mm-hmm.
Through the press or through whatever to say, look, we've, you know, we approached this mm-hmm. in a different way than, I mean, and you think about, if I'm right, in the early days of music, of popular music,
mm-hmm. recorded music.
Huh?
Popular recorded music.
Yeah, sorry, yeah. recorded music. The music industry as we
yeah,
have come
yeah.
to know it. In the early days of that, albums weren't necessarily a collection of like songs. It wasn't that a band went into the studio and said, we're going to do an album.
Right.
Music was divvied out in singles.
Yeah.
You know? A band would go
song
and
by
record
song.
A single.
Yeah.
yeah. And a lot of times... They're not even writing the songs,
yeah.
right? And I mean, I think I could be wrong here, mm-hmm. but I think the idea of an album, as we know it, was somewhat pioneered by the Beatles.
I kind of think so too.
You know that yeah. they were one of the first artists, at least on a mainstream level, to say this album is a collection of songs.
Yeah.
And they go together, you know.
With a specific intent
right.
that they be heard together or...
Right.
Yeah.
Right. That we spent a certain amount of time in the studio working on this stuff. And
mm-hmm.
this is what we've come out with.
This is a capture, a snapshot
yeah.
of where we are right now.
Right.
In the creative
process. And I wonder then, that being the case, if it's true,
mm-hmm.
if Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band... was the first concept album. I don't know. I just have no clue.
That seems like a reasonable...
But it could have been.
Assumption or supposition.
It would not surprise me if the Beatles were the first to knowingly do a concept album,
yes.
right? To,
yeah.
To go into the studio with the idea that every song on this album will tell one story,
yeah.
right? And I wish, you know, if I'm being very honest, I don't know Sgt. Pepper well enough to even say if it is a concept album.
Yeah.
This is all anecdotal
yeah.
on my part. I, from what I understand, it is. And that, you know, there's a common thread there.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't.
It makes sense. It makes
yeah.
sense.
And I've heard the album, but it's been a long time. And as far as my... knowledge of the Beatles, it mostly is in like single songs. My awareness of the Beatles doesn't exist album by album.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
You know?
I think our generation and probably the generation before us, that's sort of how we got to know the Beatles
yeah.
was, you know, by specific songs.
Yeah.
But no, I think you're right. And I think it makes sense too if you consider that they sort of already had kind of a storytelling background from the movies, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of, it seems like a logical transition that they would try to do something like that with an album.
Well, because when they started off, they were a huge pop group, right? And,
yeah.
And they sort of...
doing all the hits.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they kind of, like, defined what a mega group is, right?
Yeah.
They are the first huge band that you know, filled stadiums and did this or that.
Yeah.
And they got burnt out on that. I mean, they touring was extremely, you know, stressful and wearing for them. I have to imagine, you know, you're doing these tours and you're in a stadium and there's, you know, 10,000 girls screaming at you. You can't hear the music you're playing.
Right.
Right. So they stopped touring. They were like, that's it. We're not touring anymore. We are only going to make music in studios and that's it. Yeah. Right. They, at a point in their career, they made that decision. And so to me, that is why, or maybe that is where this desire to make those albums something special, an endeavor or an exercise in doing something more. Because they did Sgt. Pepper. The White Album is a double album.
Mm-hmm.
And one might say a concept album.
Mm-hmm.
Everything they did once they got into the studio started to become kind of this trying to go beyond just what music is and what the expectations of recorded music are.
Did Sgt. Pepper come after Rubber Soul?
I'm not sure.
Because I remember reading about the Beach Boys and Brian Wilson and how
Pet Sounds
is essentially a concept album.
Yeah.
And it was inspired by Rubber Soul.
Okay.
Like, I remember he listened to that and he's like, well, this is incredible.
Yeah.
An incredible way to approach music. And so that
Pet Sounds is an amazing album.
Pet Sounds is not only, like, obviously the best Beach Boy album, I think. I don't think anybody would argue against that. But I think it's also one of the best albums of all time.
Mm.
And I'm not a Beatles guy. I think we talked about this.
Yeah.
So, admittedly, I don't think I've heard enough Beatles to say whether or not I can appreciate that. I can appreciate them as innovators. I don't necessarily appreciate them as songwriters.
The music, right, sure.
But I love Pet Sounds, and I totally appreciate the Beach Boys, or Brian Wilson, I guess, specifically, because of how layered that is and how...
What would you say the concept behind Pet Sounds is?
I think it is obsessive devotion to sonic detail.
Nice.
That's the best way I could describe, in a nutshell, Pet Sounds.
I like that.
Thought about this before, but maybe that's what the name is supposed to indicate, you know. It's like this is somebody's it's his project, you know. It's just his tinkering, you know, with musical obsession and seeing what happens, what he can draw out of it.
I think a lot of concept albums are a result of obsession.
Definitely.
You need to have a sort of obsessive nature to truly to devote yourself to that endeavor, I think, and to have it really come out the other end as something that does have a unification to it.
That people can recognize.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you hear, I mean, with these concept albums, there's always these stories around the recording of them, you know, that there's always something, that some sort of myth or legend around the recording of these things, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that just adds to the overall coolness of them.
Yeah. Circumstances, the recording process, you know, are reflected in the project. Like, I think they ultimately influence how it turns out.
Yeah.
You know, even if... I think this is done on purpose, too. But, you know, that process, the particular place that it happens, whatever's going on at the time in the world, all of those things, I think, manifest in a concept album if they're in sync, you know, if whoever is putting this together is really on their game, then I think.
Well, that makes me think of two different albums that the recording of the album was extremely influential in the result. London Calling, by The Clash, is a double album. And I think one could say a concept album in that they were heavily experimenting, firstly, beyond what they were traditionally doing.
Yeah.
Right? The two albums that preceded it were pretty much straight punk rock.
Yeah.
You know? And in London Calling, The Clash pulls in reggae and ska and jazz and, you know, various other influences into that album. But the circumstances by which they recorded it, they had just left their old label, I think. Something like that. So they couldn't record where they usually did. Or they couldn't practice where they usually did, or something like that. And the producer that they hired for that album, I can't remember his name, but it was apparently insane to some degree, that he would try to evoke different emotional states in the band during recording because he felt it would carry through into the recording itself. So he's reputed for, like, swinging ladders around them and throwing chairs. And I think, like, at one point, one of them, when they were playing the piano, he was pouring, like, champagne over their hands and the piano as they recorded. What? Like, and there's footage of this stuff. I mean, there's a documentary about the recording of London Calling, and you can see him doing some of this stuff. And he's basically just creating an environment, sort of a charged environment for them to kind of create in, I guess. But I feel like that album is a concept album in as much as it's an exploration of music for them. You know, they were very much trying to investigate music and their relationship to it.
I think it has like some, it's not as explicit maybe as some other ones, but I think there's a thematic line throughout that album too. I mean, it's maybe not anti-consumerism or anti-capitalism, but it's there's sort of like a...
I think it is very much an album that is looking at society and commenting on the flaws of it.
That's a good...
You know, they talk about there's the oppression and racism and drugs and... sort of the working man, you know, all of these things are addressed in that album.
Yeah.
So it's sort of a take on society as they saw it in 1979.
Yeah.
I think.
I agree.
That's what I think.
Yeah. Maybe we're wrong. Maybe they should tell us.
Wrong.
London calling through the faraway towns. Now war is declared and battle come down. London calling to the underworld. Come out of the cupboard, you boys and girls. London calling, now don't look to us. Phony Beatlemania is bitten the dust. London calling, see we ain't got no swing except for the rain and the crunching thing. The ice is coming, the sun's zooming in.
meltdown expected. The wheat is good thin. Engines stop running, but I have no fear, 'cause London is drowning. I live by the river to the imitation zone. Forget it, brother, you can go it alone.
The other album that the environment of recording comes up is the self-titled album by Blink-182. Mm. I don't know if it's really a concept album.
Mm-hmm.
The only way I could give it that title is because they all moved into a house and recorded the whole album in this house together.
Mm-hmm.
And experimented a lot with recording methods.
Uh-huh.
You know, they would like pipe, they would set up a speaker where they had recorded something next to a microphone and record the recording,
mm-hmm,
to get some kind of effect. Like they were really playing around with different techniques.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, you could attribute the name of concept album to that album, because the concept is, you know, sort of
exploring.
Yeah.
Sort of finding themselves,
yeah,
finding out,
and
yeah,
I think,
which is why, you know,
you, that comes through in that album, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is an incredible departure from their previous stuff.
Which is, and it sort of makes sense then that it's, you know, the self-titled,
yeah,
or whatever,
yeah, totally,
you know. It's sort,
yeah,
of that culmination of them,
yeah,
exploring themselves. I was thinking, well, this one came to mind, and it's maybe not a great example, but like thinking about the whole idea of recording in a house and stuff, I think that it seems like the results of that process, whether it's a concept album or not, like with that album, with that Blink album, it's a very defining moment, and it
yeah,
really, there's a very strong sense of place and
yeah,
you know, there's a vibe from that album. And I don't know that you get that so much from albums where people are just sort of showing up.
Yeah,
like,
exactly,
you know, they're just coming, yeah, in, recording their parts,
yeah,
and they're leaving. I feel like when people are staying together or, mm-hmm, you know, living together, the results tend to be, I don't know if better is the word, but maybe more potent.
They feel lived in. They feel sort of...
Yeah. I think it helps with the cohesion. So that's why I,
yes,
think with a concept album, it's particularly important. If you're,
yes,
if you're trying to keep that everything synchronous, then I think it's important that the recording process,
yeah,
has that too.
Yeah,
you know?
Definitely.
And I'm thinking of, there was the Marilyn Manson album, Antichrist Superstar.
Mm-hmm.
And I, this is probably just because it's one of the only like recording stories that I know,
uh-huh,
you know, that's why it probably sticks into me. But so the band apparently like, they were living in a house that was like haunted or something, supposedly haunted at the time. That's where they were recording with Nine Inch Nails guy, Trent Reznor.
Okay, yeah.
He was there. And they apparently, obviously, I don't think this will be a surprise, but experimented with drugs and stuff, uh-huh, while they were in the process, but also sleep deprivation.
Oh.
And I think that really comes out in that album.
Mm.
There's a sense of being really strung out.
Hmm.
You know, mentally, and,
yeah,
and sort of pushed to the point where you're not really sure what you're seeing. You know, you can't really interpret, huh, things very well, accurately. So that, yeah, that whole process, I think, is really, it's a big deal.
You were going to ask, you know, I think you were going to ask, what was your first,
yeah, yeah,
experience of the concept album?
Yeah. So something where you knew going into it that there's an overall theme or,
oh,
something.
That I knew.
Yeah,
I knew going into it. Probably, let me think for a second.
And it doesn't have to be like a new album. It can be something that's,
yeah,
old,
yeah,
and you're,
yeah,
just,
yeah,
listening,
yeah,
to it for the first time. Or
well, I think the first time I knew going into it,
mm-hmm,
was American Idiot by,
okay,
Green Day. Now, I had certainly experienced concept albums prior to that,
mm-hmm,
without knowing it. But that was the first time I was in on it, that,
uh-huh,
I knew what was coming. Well, I didn't know what was coming, but I knew that that what was coming was meant to be.
There was a specific,
yeah,
intent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And man, was I blown away. I just could not. I can still remember this, like a visceral feeling of just disbelief in what I was hearing.
Mm.
And the... the first track, American Idiot, is, it's good,
mm-hmm.
but it's the second track, Jesus of Suburbia, where I just couldn't, you know, it's basically a song in five acts or mm-hmm. whatever. And I was not, first of all, I was excited just by the track list, seeing that this song was like five parts long or something.
Yeah, yeah.
But then to hear the song and hear it build and get more and more insane and just like feeling the sense of satisfaction and excitement. I'd mm-hmm. never been that excited about something that I was listening to,
hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then like from that track forward, I'm just like, this is going to be incredible. And it was, you know, mm-hmm. like from track to track. And and the whole time too, I was thinking, man, I want to feel like, this is all great, but I also really want to feel what I just felt with that second track.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And I think it delivers in the end with the second to last track, Homecoming, where they again do a sort of a song in five acts or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of the answer to that first one, the
yeah.
second track, you know?
Yeah. They really, really nailed the structure, I
yes.
think, of like
yeah.
a at least a rock opera, if yeah. not like the structure of a concept album.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if that such a thing
yeah,
exists,
they,
but
they,
I think like, you
yeah.
know, like that first song is sort of like a place marker.
Yeah.
It's like saying, here's where this story takes place,
yes.
you know?
Yeah.
And then like, you've got the Jesus of Suburbia launches it.
Yeah.
It sets the stage,
introduces you to characters.
Right. And then the Homecoming sort
yeah.
of is like that's the end of the action. You
yeah.
know? That's like, that's the end of the arc.
Yeah.
And then the last one,
what's her name?
Is like, that's
Coda.
The epilogue.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. That's the Coda, exactly.
Yeah.
yeah, that's the words on the screen that say,
yeah.
so-and-so went on to become a doctor.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
yeah.
It's really great.
Yeah.
And you know, we had talked about this before, and I think this totally illustrates the idea behind a concept album. I mean, I can go through the song track, or the album track by track, and be like, you know, that song's okay.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not a great song. Or this song's phenomenal, you know?
Mm-hmm.
As individual tracks on their own, I think that there are some duds in there,
uh-huh.
but as a one thought, you know, carried through as one concept, it is phenomenal.
Yeah,
I mean, it is so good, and it's tight, and it's concise. I feel like they don't meander anywhere really. They kind of just the story
Stay
moves
on
at
target.
A great pace.
Yeah.
yeah, and it gives you a nice short little chunk of what they're trying to say.
Yeah.
You know, and I read up about the creation of it and it too has a story.
Oh, I want to hear this.
And so what happened was they had just recorded, you know, they just had Warning. Warning had just come out
uh-huh.
and they, you know, toured for Warning and Warning was kind of a, folk punk kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at this point, they're kind of on, they're at a point as a band where they're no longer the, you know, the kids that they were for Kerplunk or for Dookie.
The bratty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, they kind of are trying to figure out who they are as a band at this point, right?
Mm-hmm.
With Insomniac and Nimrod and Warning. They're starting to explore beyond their punk rock roots or what have you, but
mm-hmm.
Not really taking chances
mm-hmm.
as a band, you know, or perhaps not fully accepting what they are.
Mm-hmm.
And and I think Billy Joe Armstrong even said that with American Idiot, they accepted that they were rock stars, that, you know, that's the identity of Green Day now. Like
mm-hmm.
they can't make any claims to being, you know,
underground or
yeah, grassroots yeah. or whatever. They're a rock band and
right.
they're a huge rock band. Right. So, they went into the studio and they recorded an album called, Cigarettes and Valentines,
mm-hmm.
apparently. And the master tracks, most of the master tracks were stolen.
That's right. I do remember this now. Yeah.
So they lost.
Were they ever found? Or did they ever turn
up?
No,
but there were there were backup recordings reportedly.
Oh, okay.
But the producer or maybe their manager, somebody, you know, sat them, like they went to somebody for advice. They were, they're like, you know, should we re-record it? What should we do? And whoever this was, I think it was a producer, said, do you think it was the best, your best work?
Yeah.
Like, do you think it was the best you could have done?
Mm-hmm.
And they admitted, no, that wasn't, you know, the best we could have done. And so they made that choice then to not re-record it, to do, to start over completely
from scratch.
And to push themselves as far as they could, right? Mm-hmm. To like, to constantly question, is this the best that we can do, you know, and try to be as sort of hard and, you know, angry and
cutthroat.
Yeah. Like push as far as they can for that album.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what resulted. And the first thing they wrote was Homecoming.
Hmm.
And Mike Dirnt, who's the bassist, said that that came out of, like, he would record like a 30-second bit, and then Billy Joe would come in and try to up that, like one up it, and then Trey would try to one up it, and they kind of went back and forth, and that eventually became Homecoming.
Oh, cool.
And then they, after writing Homecoming, they wrote Jesus of Suburbia, and I think from there they kind of pulled
they
together
had the structure.
What the story was, yeah.
Nice.
Get my television fixed. Sitting on my crucifix, I live in Rome. All my private home, walk the moms and brides away. To follow love and follow dad. To uncle all the cigarettes and Mary Jane. To keep me insane.
The danger of the concept album is that you want to keep doing concept albums.
Yeah.
And they followed that album with 21st Century Breakdown, which is another concept album.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, I would not say it's a bad album by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, it's a good Green Day album. But it is nowhere, following American Idiot and attempting to do something similar,
mm-hmm.
I think was a huge mistake. And it just simply doesn't deliver the way that, to me, it feels bloated.
Mm-hmm.
There's too much going on. It's clear that they're trying to create.
It's a little too conscious,
yeah,
subconscious.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think that can be the danger. And I think The Clash also kind of had that issue with the follow-up to London Calling, which was Sandinista, which was another double album, I think. And it just felt...
It was a triple album, wasn't it?
Is it? Yeah, it might be.
Yeah, it's three.
And in the same way that London Calling was them exploring music, I mean, they took that to the nth degree with Sandinista.
Yeah.
And it felt very indulgent to me.
Ah,
you know, that...
Yeah,
that
I think is the danger, yeah. That right there, indulgence.
It went beyond obsession or wanting to make a statement, and it became more of wanting to, you know, you sort of had this success, or you accomplished this feat,
mm-hmm.
of the concept album, and now you're like, you want to go further, and you're just kind of serving yourself at that point.
Yeah, well, and it's almost like you're not trying to do something. You've already done it. So you're coming from a place of confidence, knowing that you have done this. So you're not as hungry, I think, as
and you almost have a goal in mind like, whereas before you had a goal in mind, you didn't know what it looked like, mm-hmm. in a way, you know, you kind of, you had a vague idea of what it should be, but you're kind of, I would imagine, I mean, obviously I've never recorded a concept album, but I would imagine you're sort of striving for something that you don't really know what the shape is, yeah. you know, but coming at it for a second time, you kind of have an idea of what it could become. Right.
Right.
And so it seems like somewhat disingenuous in a way to attempt that again,
mm-hmm.
you know? But going back to Green Day, their next sort of effort now is a 3-album release that's happening across 6 months or so, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, they've released a few singles. The album comes out not this week, but next week, I think. The first one.
I think as of the release of this episode, it will have just come
right,
out.
Oh, right, right. As we record it now.
Yeah.
As we record this episode, it is not out. But when you hear this episode, it may be out.
I think it is.
May have just come out the day before.
Yeah.
We're
so good. We're so good with timing.
Yeah, yeah.
Look at that.
And the album is called Uno.
Yeah.
And the others are called Dos and Trey. And early reviews, one early review, has said that it is a return to sort of the... collection of songs album that mm-hmm. it's not a concept album, but mm-hmm. it is a multi-release, you know,
right.
which we talked about sort of, it is a trilogy of albums, at least in name, Uno,
right.
Dos, Trey, right?
And the imagery associated with them is very, it's similar.
They recorded everything. This is all from one, you know, one effort.
Session.
Yeah. This isn't over years of recording. This is,
right.
this is a concerted effort to put out 3 albums worth of songs. It should be interesting to see what these albums just, you know, what they come down to in the end.
How it works out. Yeah. Ultimately.
Yeah. And I want to be optimistic.
Yeah.
I am hesitant to be simply because the amount of songs, it is hard to believe that they could sustain a good
run
in 3 albums. Yeah. In such a short amount of time.
Yeah.
But, they may prove me wrong.
But that brought up an interesting thought, like talking about kind of the, I guess going into the double album or the dual release mm-hmm. album where you're sort of, it's not maybe so much a thematic thread as it is just a very big record release.
An event.
You know,
like you said, like a spectacle.
In that situation, I feel like the onus is a little bit lesser on having a complete thing. You know, I feel like it's a little more forgivable, permissible in that situation for there to be some pretty drastic holes within the thing, you know? And I'm thinking like the dual albums that I've heard, you know, Springsteen had one that was like a double album, The River. And that, you know, there's some great songs on it. And there's songs that I will never, ever listen to again. Guns N' Roses did Use Your Illusion. That was probably the first one that I ever, like,
I mean,
knew
that
about.
That was a huge... And we kind of talked about it a bit, right? On the 90s music
episode.
Because that was the lead up to the 90s in a way. Like, Use Your Illusion came out right...
It was 91.
Right.
It came out... I think it came out, like... 2 weeks before or 2 weeks after Nevermind or something that.
Yeah.
And
it was the sort of dying kind of swan song of that sort of hair
that
metal.
Era.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's both of those albums have some incredibly good songs. And I think overall, the most of them are pretty good, but there are a few like real big clunkers in that.
What was I mean, do you know the history at all around that album? Like,
well, it was the next Guns N' Roses album.
Right.
Like, you know, they put out Appetite for Destruction in 87, mm-hmm. and it really didn't take hold, I think, until 88. That's mm-hmm. when they sort of became, you know, huge and where that album, you know, got big. So they sort of had a little bit of leeway there. You know, they're like, they're still living off of that album for a good year or so.
But this is the first album to be released when they are a huge thing, right?
Well, and it was their first album since Appetite.
Right.
So that came out, Appetite for
but
Destruction
Appetite
came out
made
in 87.
Them what they were, right? Like right, Appetite yeah. brought them into the spotlight.
Yeah, that defined Guns N' Roses, right? And they put out an EP in 89.
Mm-hmm.
And then this long period, you know, yeah. I mean, people have been waiting for a new Guns N' Roses album
yeah.
since 1987. Yeah. It's now 1991. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a long time. If you're used to a model where a successful band puts out an album every year or yeah. two, you know, and most of Guns N' Roses contemporaries at the time were doing that, like,
yeah.
you know, Def Leppard and Metallica and, right. you know, all those bands were all, you know, churning out albums every couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And they, in a way, it's sort of, you know, it made them a bigger band. It enhanced their legend as being this reckless, untamable force.
We won't play by your rules.
They just, yeah, you know, they are so chaotic
yeah.
that they cannot sit down and record another album. You know, it's sort of like it fueled that legend behind them.
Right.
The fact that they just couldn't get it together.
Right.
You know, they were such a
well. That makes me think. And just a quick sidetrack of,
yeah.
And this really has nothing to do with concept albums or anything. But the Sex Pistols, right? I mean, didn't they only have one album?
They have one album. Yeah,
and they toured, and that was it.
Yeah.
And so they are sort of considered by a lot of people as the quintessential punk band, like so, you know, so reckless, so
volatile
that they can't even stay together beyond one album, one
yeah.
tour, you know, like that is.
Yeah.
Kind
yeah.
of thing. Anyway, so the Appetite for Destruction made them what they are. It's been 4 years. People are like, oh my God, we need another Guns N' Roses album.
Mm-hmm.
At what point is it made known that it's a double album?
I think it was that summer. It was summer of 91 when they
mm-hmm. so
people know, finally
must have been flipping out.
Oh my God, yeah. Well, I don't remember what the reaction was to it. It was the same summer.
Well, I mean, just the news.
Yeah, yeah. I know that it was anticipated, you know.
Right.
I know people were like waiting outside of stores at midnight for the
yeah.
albums to come out, and you know, you'd see people. It's funny when you go back and look at this footage, like most people are picking up both of them, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to the store at midnight and they're buying them both. But there's these random one-offs where you see somebody coming out of the store holding up like, I got Use Your Illusion 2, and you're like, What
That's
kind
awesome.
Of person is devoted enough to wait outside of
yeah.
a store at midnight?
Just get one.
But they're not devoted enough to actually buy both albums.
They couldn't afford both.
Maybe.
That's the
I
only way
know.
I can see that.
That
is excellent.
South of West Central Spain, drinking off the pain. 'Cause inside I'm broke, I'm cracked, I'm alone. No hope for a change, no way to erase the world could be better without me. So how could this be?
Staying in the vein of multi-release, there's one, so Saves the Day put out a trilogy of albums, and they didn't all come out at once, but there's a concept here. You could say that this trilogy is a concept trilogy in a way,
mm-hmm.
And in it, in these three albums, they sort of explore the idea of sort of dealing with mental degradation or sort of insecurity and a feeling, a lack of sort of love, both internally and feeling it, not feeling externally. And it goes from the three albums. The first is called Sound the Alarm. The second is called Under the Boards. And the third is Daybreak. And they came out pretty far apart from one another. I mean,
they weren't planned, right? They weren't.
It was planned.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
This was planned. But the problem with it was that they were so, it's not like these came out 1 month after the other, like years apart, these mm-hmm. came out. So he put out Sound the Alarm, and I was, you know, am still a huge fan of the band, Save the Day. And so this came out, I thought that wasn't bad. It felt kind of strange as an album, just because it's somewhat harkened back to their very early albums in a way, mm-hmm. but it had their polished sound that they mm-hmm. didn't have then. And then a few years later, Under the Boards came out, and I just felt like, oh, this is not good.
Mm-hmm.
It starts off pretty good, and then it just descends into this air, this sort of like depression that I just could not get into, you know? And I just couldn't follow them there. And then recently, maybe I think like last year, Daybreak came out. It's the third album. And I thought, okay, all three are out. I should listen to all three now mm-hmm. in a row. And when Daybreak came out, obviously I listened to it on its own first and just thought it was phenomenal. I mean, I was so happy. It was mm-hmm. such a good album. But then I listened to all three, and it made sense. It worked. And that second album made sense in the structure of the three albums. Because the first album of the trilogy is kind of about paranoia mm-hmm. and sort of thinking that everyone's out to get you and that, you know, you're a victim and all this stuff. The second album is the descent into just descent into oneself, really.
Mm-hmm.
Like becoming not wanting to feel anything and feeling that there is nothing to feel in mm-hmm. a way. And it ends on the darkest kind of note. That's why I had such a hard time with it. But then you follow it with Daybreak, and the first track on Daybreak is sort of a celebration of kind of like coming back up from that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so
sort of triumphant.
Yeah. And it's so satisfactory and rewarding and just, it made that whole second album make sense. And so,
nice.
and Daybreak is all about learning to love again and realizing that you have to love in order to receive love in a way, you know?
Uh-huh.
So it was a really nice kind of three album deal, but it was hard. I think it was difficult to go with them on the journey because the separation of the release of those three albums was so great. You know, you really had to
sort of risky
be
endeavor.
Dedicated. Yeah.
Yeah.
But in the end it paid off, I think.
Nice.
Good stuff.
So what are some of your other favorite, either concept or big albums?
I think one of the best concept albums ever is Pink Floyd's The Wall.
Yeah.
And I've gotten to see it performed live by Roger Waters and others. Because Pink Floyd is no more. Like
right.
they're just not gonna, they don't really like each other. but a lot of people will say that Roger Waters, who is a member of Pink Floyd, is the creative kind of mind
Lynchpin.
Behind the band.
Yeah,
yeah. Like that he is Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
A lot of people would say that. But The Wall is an album about sort of, it's kind of similar to what I was just talking about with Saves the Day, where it's an album about a character they called Pink.
Mm-hmm.
And he's supposed to be sort of an amalgamation of the four band members. But it's a story of a kid whose father dies in World War II. His mother is overbearing, overprotective, and kind of damages him in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So that as he grows up, he becomes more and more distanced from people, mm-hmm. and, you know, and in a very literal sense starts building walls. And he gets married, but then his marriage falls apart. When his marriage falls apart, that's when he sort of completes the wall. Mm. And then once he's built the wall, it sort of goes inside of his head, and he imagines himself as a dictator. He puts himself on trial by the end of it, and then tears the wall down and mm-hmm. exposes himself again. It's a really cool kind of story.
Yeah.
But what makes it, and the music is great. I mean, the album itself is just great. But what really takes it beyond every other concept album, in my opinion, is the stage show that goes along with it.
Mm.
And the idea for the album and the stage show came from they were touring before they went into the studio again. And Roger Waters was getting more and more frustrated with the crowd, with the audience. And it got to a point where he actually like spat on a group of, you know, fans that were watching them perform. And he thought to himself, you know, he wanted to put a wall between him and the audience. And that's kind of what generated the idea. And then, you know, they went into the studio and sort of parse that out right into mm-hmm. what it became. So in the actual stage show, when they first toured it, it was so expensive, they could only do 4 shows. Hmm. So I think they did 2 in Europe and 2 in the US, or maybe it was 1 in the US, I'm not sure. And the stage show consisted of them literally building a wall. They actually build a wall between the band and the audience, progressively throughout the show. And, you know, the building of the wall coincides with the songs.
Uh-huh.
So for instance, I think the last song on the first side of the album is Goodbye Cruel World. And mm-hmm. at the end of the song, they put the last
complete
brick
the last
in the
piece.
Wall. Nice. And he's standing behind it. So you can see Roger Waters standing, you know, in this one hole, and the bricks are like, they're big bricks,
but yeah, yeah.
You can see him back there. And as he finishes the last lyric, they slide the last brick in. And then that's sort of intermission
uh-huh.
before you come back for the second half of the show. But there's like, they project, animation onto the wall. They have these inflatable like characters that stand in for the mother and teachers and all this stuff. And it is an incredible production. And I got to see it.
Wow.
Roger Waters, you know, like I said, when they first released it, I think in 1980 it came out. It was so expensive to stage the show. They could only do 4 shows.
Mm-hmm.
And then they did another one. They staged it, or at least Roger Waters staged it again, when the Berlin Wall came down. And he did a production of the wall on the site of the Berlin Wall.
Nice.
And he had like all these major kind of acts come and help do the show and stuff. And I think there's like video, there's a DVD of that or something.
Do you think the people in Berlin were like, no, we just got it down. No,
you're building it again. but then recently, I think last year, or maybe the year before, he did another tour of the wall. And now he can accomplish things he couldn't accomplish before with better technology for less money, I guess. Or maybe he just has more money. I don't know.
Probably both. Yeah.
So my dad and I went to see it, and it is, I mean, I already liked the album, mm-hmm. right? But I had never seen the show, and it is such an incredible experience of, you know, just synergy between music and stage show.
Mm-hmm. Theatrics.
And yeah. And it is such a spectacle, and it's so cool. And I can remember, it was like a year ago, but I remember having, The one song that my dad used to play all the time for us as kids was the Another Brick in the Wall, where it's talking about kids versus teachers, basically, you know, and he would play that for us and we'd sing along and we thought it was really funny, not realizing the implication of the full, you know, story. But when that song, when he played that song live, when I saw it, I mean, I got choked up. That, because, you know, obviously there's a lot of like stuff, context that I have around that song,
right? Sure,
from personal experience, but just hearing it live and seeing the production, and he brings out a bunch of kids onto stage to sing it, and they sing it at this inflatable like monster of a teacher, you know, and it's just phenomenal. I can't convey how good it is.
I really want to see that.
If he ever does it again, and you have the opportunity. I mean, it is worth the money. It is so cool. And it one of the best moments of it is at the end of the show when they do the trial, he puts himself on trial inside of his mind. And by the end of the trial, his sentence is to tear down the wall. And people start chanting, "Tear down the wall."
Oh,
and
nice.
So the whole audience starts, you know, saying that. And as the chant goes, the wall crumbles in front of you. You know, this wall that has been built falls apart, and then the song that follows is this really sort of it's just sort of a stroke of genius, because the whole production up to that point is so huge, you know, big instruments, lots of sound effects, like sonically it is extremely jam-packed, and that last song is basically a guitar, you know, really soft and really kind of exposed. I mean, in the way that final song, he has finally exposed himself to the world again. The song itself does that, you know, the same thing. And it's such a contrast to what you've heard all the way up to that point. And it's a huge kind of relief.
Perfect,
you
know? Way to cap
and it
off.
It was beautiful. It was just really incredible. Great stuff. So that's probably, I think, and it's the first concept album that I ever heard.
Oh yeah.
Was The Wall.
That's awesome. I do want to see that now.
Yeah, it is. It is worth it. Very much worth it.
Do you think we could do an archive concept album?
Oh, what would be our concept? Could we?
I guess we got to start there.
Well, a concept would have to be an archive about the archive.
Oh, I like that.
We would have to archive the archives that we've already archived. Oh. Right? We would have to like talk about each episode, but talk about the episode.
Comment on our comments.
Right.
On,
we would have to say, you know, I can remember when we talked about arcades. And is that the only way we
but
could
we have
do
to
it?
Sing it? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It would have to be a triple album. Yeah.
I like it.
I think we could do it.
All right.
So are we? So should we archive this?
Oh.
Wait. How do we conceptually put this in the archive? Maybe we'll work on that.
Okay.
Just put it in the archive for now.